Okay, so I think this is my last slide with some equations. So if you have any questions before I leave this slide, let me know. Yes, questions?
No, we've just been noticing there's an orientation factor.
Yeah. So, you know, what I'll do, I'll just sit here and then talk like that, if that's okay. Okay, so so this is where that expression came from, and if you plot this function here as a function of distance, then energy transfer efficiency goes from 100% down to zero, and there is a range of distance where this change occurs quite rapidly and in an almost linear way, so that you can imagine that small distance changes in on the order of 5 to 10 angstroms along this line can result in sizable change in this direction, and this is in fact large enough to be detected even from single molecules. So if you're lucky that your conformational change occurs between this point in distance and another point somewhere here, then it'll be very easy to detect. And in fact, sometimes you can even see four, five, six different states. You can resolve many different states along this direction because sometimes you get enough photons to do that. So this technique is called spectroscopic ruler, because depending on the distance between the two dye molecules, you get either a very strong red signal due to energy transfer or very strong green signal or some in between. So what we do is just measure the relative intensities of the two colors and approximate the Frey efficiency as a ratio between the red intensity and the sum of the two intensities of donor, green and red. So now we are talking about doing single molecule measurements using two dyes, the power of two. So 10 years ago, it was my final year of my PhD with Shimon Weiss and in collaboration with Paul Servin, and Daniel Shemna was my official advisor in Berkeley. So I, as a struggling student, I finally published a paper from my PhD. And it turned out to be the first measurement of single molecule FRET. And the abstract ended with this sentence, obviously inserted by some visionaries. We said that this could be used to monitor conformational changes within single biological molecules in the future. And I thought it was something that you have to do to get a paper published. I didn't believe a word of it, but it became a reality. So when Shimon and Paul say something, listen to them. So you can now, for example, tether single biomolecules to a surface using biotin avidin in a non-perturbative way, and then follow the conformational dynamics using FRET. The time resolution that you can get is maybe down to about 100 microseconds. I think Everett can do about 100 microsecond measurements from diffusing molecules. And it's, in our measurements, what's more typical is about 5 to 10 milliseconds time resolution. It's limited by photon count, shot noise, and also ultimately limited by the photophysics of the dye molecules. And distance resolution is on the order of a few angstroms. In a conservative estimate, and it is limited by the shot noise due to photon flux, and you can imagine measuring these changes between 30 and 70 angstroms. For example, if the changes occur between 10 and 20 angstroms, it'll be very difficult to measure. Same with between 80 and 90 angstroms, and so on. So this is our favorite model system called Holliday junction, named after Robin Holliday, who proposed this DNA Fourier junction structure as an intermediate in DNA recombination about 50 years ago. So this molecule made of four strands of DNA obtains this open conformation, as shown here, when you have no ions in solution. So basically, you have four cylinders forming this structure. But once you go into more physiological conditions where you have ions, divalent ions such as magnesium ions, then you see a more compact structure shown in this Shinho's crystal structure. And this structure is called a stacked X structure because it looks like an X. And by symmetry, there are two stacked conformations shown here and here, isomers or conformers, two of them. So there are two more or less isoenergetic conformations of the molecule that are highly populated. Then you can imagine that one could use single molecule FRET by putting the dyes in the right positions to measure the transitions between the two conformations, okay, back and forth. It turns out that when you vary the magnesium concentrations, you actually stabilize both of these conformations, and you slow down this exchange rates, you know, simultaneously. So this dynamics turns out to be non-synchronizable, and it was not possible to measure the kinetic exchange using conventional kinetic tools because of that. Also, you can argue that because of the compact shape, to go from one compact shape to another, you have to unpack the structure, presumably going through this open structure as an intermediate or as a transition state, and that is not yet clear completely. So we studied a small molecule with 11 base pair arms on all four arms, and then tethered the molecule to a surface using biotin streptavidin, and then you have this green and red dyes, psi 3 and psi 5 are popular choices. In fact, these are the dyes that are used for human genome sequencing, and also they are the most popular dyes for DNA microarrays, PEP browns, and so on, affymetrix. So that you can now, in one conformation, you get high FRET because of short distance, and the other you get a low FRET. And in fact, we could measure the energy transfer efficiency fluctuating as a function of time. You can get nice, you know, clear two-state fluctuations. But shown here is a histogram of the FRET efficiency showing two populations more or less equally populated.
What were the salinity conditions?
This one was probably this is relatively slow movement, so it must be about 20 millimolar magnesium concentration.
Okay, and did you have added salt, like sodium chloride?
I think here there was none, but there is an effect of sodium. If you add 50 millimolar, then the transition becomes faster, because I think sodium actually screens the interaction between the junction and the magnesium. So effectively, you have less magnesium in solution. So I'll show you some data.
So, no, can I?
Yeah, yes, yeah.
So, should I imagine that the role of the magnesium is that it allows the food DNA to get closer by sitting in the...
Right at the junction here.
Right over there.
There are phosphate groups that are, you know, highly compacted here, and that becomes stable only when you have some magnesium ions bound there to stabilize,
right,
you know, to reduce the electrostatic repulsion. That's the idea. So that, you know, if you need to go from here to here, you know, you have to first, you know, lose those magnesium ions and so on, and that becomes more difficult at higher concentrations and so on.
So the magnesium ion is like the lock in the, it's like the key in the lock.
In a sense, yeah. Let me just skip one slide and to show you this data. So this is the data obtained at three different magnesium concentrations, 50 millimolar, 10, and 3 millimolar. They show all two-state fluctuations, but as you lower the concentration, it becomes faster and faster, while maintaining more or less one-to-one population between the two. Okay. And this is a result of transition rates as a function of magnesium concentrations. And blue is for going from, I forgot actually, one is to go from high to low FRET, the other is to go from low to high FRET, but it doesn't matter because they're the same here within our measurement noise. So basically they maintain the same ratio, just the reaction rate is changing, which is quite interesting.
And so again, what was your interpretation that the kinetics slows down if you increase the magnesium concentration?
Well, our interpretation is that when you add more magnesium ions, each structure shown here and here becomes more stable. And but to go from here to here, you have to, you know, unpack it, and that becomes more difficult. So that's the idea.
But you could equally well argue that adding magnesium is going to kill the electrostatic propulsion, so it makes it easier to fluctuate between the two states. If you have no electrostatic propulsion, you could readily go from one to the other.
Well, okay, so if you reduce magnesium ion concentrations, then electric, you know, basically energy costs of obtaining this structure will be very high. Mm-hmm. So it's not going to be very stable. So that's...
So in terms of conformation, you'd say that the Holliday junction at 90 degree angles is most stable?
When you have no ions in solution.
Do you still observe it?
We tried very hard, but we couldn't. Basically, what happens is that this would be more populated at lower magnesium concentrations,
okay.
But then, you know, if you look at our data, it becomes very fast, and then basically, you know, eventually these two states are too short lived, so you cannot resolve them. The two peak, you know, flat peaks merge into one. Then you're not sure whether that it is because of time averaging or whether you're really looking at the open structure as an intermediate.
Because I'm confused, I would have expected a very low salt that you get a 90 degree conformation, so you don't see any more fat because you freeze.
Yes, if you go to a very low salt, then you get a constant fat, okay, somewhere in between.
Oh, so even in the 90 degree orientation, you can have fat?
Yes. Yeah. So that gives you intermediate fat.
But how isn't that confusing? I mean, so. The intermediate structure also allows for resonant energy transfer, right?
Yeah, so if you look at the distances here,
yeah.
If you put imagine dice
that's,
here and here,
close enough for
oh yeah, in fact we can measure fret here too. So in the fret that we measure in here is not zero, it's about 25%.
So wouldn't it be cleaner to make it longer, so that neither in the intermediate state nor in the far state do you get any fret?
So we actually haven't really explored that. What happens is that I think if you make the arms longer, then fret in this high fret state will also become lower. Okay, so whether that will help you or not.
But thank you. Why don't you observe three states at low magnesium? Because at low magnesium, you would expect to spend very little time in the isomers 1 and 2, and longer time in the open. So I would expect to see.
Yeah. So we really wanted to see these three state fluctuations from this data, but then you know, but even this two state fluctuation becomes too fast for us to resolve. So here, at 3 millimolar magnesium, this is about 25 per second. So you know, it's about 40 millisecond dwell time, and then once it becomes much faster than that, it's very hard to even resolve two-state fluctuations. So
maybe it's okay. Maybe it means that the open state never exists. It's not the stable state. That the only stable.
That's right.
State
it's a. It is possible that it's not open state is not an intermediate. It may be a transition state. Okay.
Yes.
So then you know you cannot observe it. I'll show you some data that suggests that it may be a real intermediate. That comes from the force and fret combination. Okay.
It could be that simply low magnesium, both states have very low, very similar energy, and the barrier between the two is very small, and therefore you can.
That's exactly opposite what you expect. You expect actually that low magnesium, that the 90 degree orientation is stable, because you will get strong electrostatics. So.
But actually, I was expecting you to say something about electrostatics. In the helix itself, if the helix is sensitive, the melting temperature is sensitive. This is true to salt, at that low salt.
Isn't it known that magnesium accumulates rather specifically when helixes associate, such as in some of the RNA helices?
Maybe the association.
Yeah. So it's not, if you can think about it, the way you think about non-specific binding. And so people often worry that magnesium is doing specific binding. I don't remember the experimental crystal structure. But oftentimes,
you know,
it is in the RNA.
Yeah, so magnesium is more efficient than you know, monovalent ions, but you can actually achieve the same effect by going about 500 times higher monovalent ion concentration.
You also start to see it's you. So you're saying that if you reduce the sodium concentration, you also would see faster kinetics.
Yeah, yeah, at low sodium concentration. But once you put enough sodium, then now sodium itself can bind to the junction to stabilize the state conformation.
Comment on this, but I like it. If the helix itself is loosened up, because we know that zero salt and zero magnesium is as good as zero sodium in this case, the helix simply melts more easily. If the transition state really requires the helix to sort of have a little more yield to it, you could easily.
So, would that work in that direction?
Okay.
You imagine the cross becomes bigger at lower salt. That is.
Yeah. Okay. That's one geometric way to think about it.
The cross becomes like a big molten block.
Yeah.
That's an interesting point. Yeah. I guess we haven't really explored and measured things at very low. We had either sodium or magnesium present.
There is one protein crystal structure where you're really seeing a melted little base pair, so they're not four arms.
That's right. It is a structure with a protein called RUB A involved in branch migration. It binds to the junction, the open form of the junction as a tetramer, and then some of the base pairs actually melted there in the crystal structure.
Because there's a lot of electrostatic repulsion right at the center of that cross. You're jamming all of these charges together.
Yeah.
So it could be structurally unstable.
Yeah.
And it's exactly the hinge you need for this foot floppy.
I just want to mention that this bias between the two states is a function of DNA sequence, and that was known before from gel studies. And in fact, when we tested two different sequences that are known to have no bias and strong bias to one conformation, we found no bias. This is one sequence, and in the other sequence, we found a strong bias in FRET to the high-FRET state. And even the direction was in the right direction. High-FRET state was predicted to have a higher population. So this gives us some confidence that what we're measuring is real. Okay. So basically you see a tiny ticker that ticks between the two conformations. And this is not driven by, yes?
Trying to get A and B sort of
out there. A is the acceptor.
No, that's
yeah,
easy
yeah.
Part.
You can there's a green guy and a red guy and a blue guy and a white guy.
Oh, you're talking about the coloring of the helices. Yeah.
No, I'm just thinking in terms of the red, it's sort of like the switching positions.
So this is a green helix here.
Yeah. Maybe it's the angle I'm sitting at.
So green helix is now stacked on top of the red helix to form one super helix.
Absolutely.
Okay.
Yeah.
Blue against the white.
Right.
And this is the reason why this is called stacked X, because you have two stacks of helices forming an X shape.
Right.
But in this conformation, the green pairs up with blue instead of red.
I was trying to make it do this, and really it's doing that.
It's not just this, and it's more complex. Yeah.
So it really opens up what Robin was talking about. There are all kinds of things. That
yeah, I think I made this animation. Oops.
Can you rule out tetrahedral geometry?
No. But this animation basically, shows the imaginary unstacking of the helices going through an open conformation.
Shouldn't you have it rotate at the same time?
Well, I did the animations. I was not capable of making rotation. Okay, let me just close. So what I wanted to mention is that this looks like a pendulum to me. While the pendulum ticks using the gravitational energy, but in this case we have a ticker that ticks using the thermal energy back and forth all the time, and the ticking frequency depends on ion concentration, but also that'll be the gravity, equivalent to gravity, but it also depends on the sequence. I guess that'll be equivalent of the length of the pendulum. So that's the analogy. So then the interesting question as a physicist is,
it cannot be a pendulum. A pendulum is a continuous variable. here it is the binary variable.
Yeah. Yeah. So
could you mention the angle between donor and acceptor as the angle of the pendulum?
No, because what you see is you see transition. You don't
the actual energy landscape as a function of the angle might have all kind of minima.
Yeah, so it's just a metaphor that is highly imprecise. Yeah, but it just gives me a kind of a segue. I mean, I can go into the next topic here. So, you know, if it's a pendulum, can you think about a coupled pendulum? Okay, you know, like a couple harmonic oscillators and so on. So, if you have two pendulum oscillators that have different frequencies, but let's say you have a weak spring connecting them, then you know, if you excite one pendulum, the eventually energy will slosh to the other one and back and forth. And if the spring is weak enough, then each one will maintain its own behavior. So for a while, it will behave like a regular pendulum, and so on. So can you do that? We couldn't connect two Hartree junctions using a spring, so we had to do something else. So this is a diagram that tells you about a branch migration of the four-way junction. So if you look at the sequence shown here, T A base pair can break and A T base can break, but if they are complementary to each other horizontally, then they can reform on the vertical arms. Okay, the net result is that vertical arms have lengthened by one base pair each, and horizontal arms have shortened by one base pair each. So that's branch migration, one step. And you can imagine that if the sequence is highly homologous, then this can occur, you know, back and forth. So it's a one-dimensional random walk. What I showed you earlier was a sequence where the sequence that did not allow branch migration. Okay? So it had only one branch point. Then you can imagine if you have the random walk kind of system, energy versus branch point, then you can then change the sequence so that you block out all other branch points by sequence heterology, except for the two adjacent ones. Then you can imagine that your system can be in one branch point and then hop to the next one and go back and forth. Okay, so so this is called monomigratory junction, and I visualize this one branch point as a pendulum that has two stack conformations, and occasionally it can hop to the next one and then it has its own two states, and then it can go back and forth. So that's the idea. So the idea is the following. You make this a molecule with such a sequence so it can hop back and forth between the two branch points. But of course, each branch point will have two stack conformations when you have magnesium ions in solution. So you essentially have four state system, while each system may actually oscillate between the two points, you know, tick a few times, and then hop over to the next branch point and so on. Equivalent of energy sloshing back and forth. Of course, this is not really a true equivalent, but just, you know, physical metaphor here. So when you do measurements from such a molecule, this is what we see. This is the donor and acceptor intensities in green and red that shows anti-correlated fluctuation as a function of time. This one is the energy transfer efficiency as a function of time. And it shows slow fluctuations when the molecule is in one branch point. And after a few oscillations like that, and then it suddenly shows very rapid fluctuations. And based on many different control experiments, we actually think that what happened here was that at this point in time, the molecule hopped to the next branch point in which these conformations are less stable, so they oscillate much more rapidly. And then eventually they hop back to go to a more stable branch point, and so on. So that's we have, you know, therefore seen branch migration with a single base pair resolution. We have shown that these conformations are highly dependent on the branch point.
Why is there such a difference in stability depending on position of the branch?
That was a surprise. In this case between the two there was about a factor of 20 difference in stability, and you know, sequence is different of course when you move the branch point by one step, and we have seen up to about 35-fold differences between different sequences. So what I have shown you here as a, you know, possible landscape of branch migration is not correct. It must be much more rugged than this. much more uneven. And that was the conclusion of our paper. The next topic. Yes.
Is there any chance that you can drive the system through these four states? I mean, put it differently, you presumably check that you have detailed balance in this system.
So yes,
looks
yeah.
Like effectively as an equilibrium.
Yes, 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 we have checked that.
Have you thought about whether you could generate a current so that you drive it through these four states?
Yeah, we want to manipulate it, okay? And I mean, if you want to drive a current through it, you'll have to put some free energy into it, and yes. Either, you know, you couple it to ATPase, or you have a graduate student putting in different DNA molecules all the time to the sample. That's the energy source, right? The second possibility is shown in the next topic. So, okay. So this is a topic that we call single molecule nanometronome. I'll explain the term later. So the theme here is to use a biological module to control another biological module in an unnatural way, in a way that nature probably never designed. So you have this four-way junction that I have shown you in earlier, two-state fluctuator, two-state system, and with more or less equal bias between the two, as shown here. You can measure using single molecule FRET. Now imagine adding a single strand overhang to the two arms containing the two dyes, so that four or five base pairs are complementary to each other. Okay. Then you're lengthening these two arms by a single strand overhangs. Then the length is such that they cannot pair up in one conformation shown here because they are far from each other, but they can pair up in this conformation. Then this may actually lead to additional locking of the structure into the hyperfret state that selectively stabilizes the hyperfret state. Okay? And this may even give you higher fret because of maybe angle difference. So can you do that? So we have measured this molecule, and yes, we can do that. Unlike in the previous slide, you can see a very long high fret state and short, low fret state, and so on. So you seem to be stabilizing the high fret state as you expected. The next thing that we can do is to add a strand called deactivator, which base pairs with this red strand. Okay, and then it'll basically silence the sticky ends, and it'll disable this conformation, and you will recover the original junction behavior as a regular, as a ticker. And what we actually do here is we look at one single molecule, and then we flow in this single strand DNA in high concentration while you're watching the same molecule. At 32 seconds here, you flow this in, and then boom, you see a change in behavior of that molecule that recovers this regular two-state, more or less balanced ticking behavior. We can also borrow another chapter from the book of DNA-based nanomechanics community by then flowing in the activator strand shown in pink that is complementary to this white strand overhang. And then eventually, through a three-stranded branch migration, replace the white strand from the molecule, and then you recover the original sticky end behavior. And again, using the flow cell, you can look at one molecule as you flow this, it's activated into the sample, and boom, you see the recovery of the sticky behavior.
Could you do this with RNA? Though exactly the same.
We can. I think I'm sure we can do that. We avoided RNA, and at least at this stage, because RNA is about 50 times more expensive to synthesize. So, we actually are designing experiments where we use RNA aptamers, okay, so that then this kind of response can depend on small molecules in solution.
So you could use it as a reporter for small mRNAs.
Yes, yes. Single molecule reporter.
Mm-hmm.
Probably never use. It's good, useful for publication research, but not really useful for real applications. But we actually published this paper with this title, single molecule nanometronome. The reason was that it is a ticking device. And the ticking rate can be tuned by adding DNA-based control elements, so like a metronome that can change its ticking rate. And it's nanometronome because the size is about 10 nanometer, and single molecule because we are looking at single molecule. In fact, we think that this is the first time that this DNA-based nanomechanical devices have been observed at a single molecule level. And the reviewer complained that this is not a real metronome because metronome is a regular ticker, okay? And ours is not. So we satisfy the reviewer by adding one word into the abstract. So instead of just metronome, we called it a stochastic metronome. And I think there are ways to make it a real regular metronome by, we are actually thinking about doing this, but I think there has to be energy input if you want to have a molecule at this scale that ticks really regularly. Okay, so next thing that we have done, this has not been published yet, is to combine the junction not with the double-strand DNA, but with structure called G-quadruplex, where if you have DNA sequence rich in guanine found in the telomere end of the chromosome, then you can form a structure called G-quadruplex by having four strands forming this compact structure. And this structure formation is dependent on ions such as potassium ions. So we have done the same measurement, but it turns out that in this case, this formation and dissolution of the G-quadruplex was much slower than the ticking rate. So what we saw is this behavior shown here. We have this molecule showing this quadruplex form structure, high stable high fret for a long time, and then it suddenly comes back and shows this regular high junction behavior for a while, and then it gets locked into the behavior shown here, and let me see, and you can see a single molecule going back and forth between the two behaviors. In this case, we don't have to put any external strands because the molecule itself has that ability, and the time scales actually are just amenable for this type of measurements. So the way this is all.
Just to remind me, what's the time tick mark here?
Sorry. Probably the whole trace that I showed is about a minute. Uh-huh. So.
I mean a millisecond, like this distance or something.
It's
like
always a millisecond.
It's always a millisecond. It's the law of nature.
Yeah,
like
KBT
first law. Well, our time resolution is about, and in here is about 10 milliseconds for this measurement. Maybe 8 milliseconds. So a single data point, I think it's 8 milliseconds here. So,
the reason I guess is because Klaus walked in, and I was just thinking in terms of that small a molecule, how many possible configurations, what happens in a millisecond. It's quite a good smaller item to look at, but look at one.
You hold the paper together, it should not be more fair.
Oh. With him, or
one of the lucky we're taking, but the holiday junction is really very complex.
Uh-huh.
If you once you resolve it to the molecular level, it's amazing that it worked like a clock.
Yeah.
But once you evolve it.
That's the question. So what? How much happens in a millisecond? Is it trying 10,000 times and failing, or is it get still so many confirmations it has to go through? It?
Ask me about the nanoseconds.
Yeah. I tried to find an easy problem for you.
Yeah, Klaus is a really good student. She knew computational work here, and found a structure that looks like a tetrahedral instead of this open structure that could be the intermediate in the transition between the two forms. And the paper was published about 2 years ago.
So you have measured migration rates of this Halliday junction.
This one is not migratable. The sequence is chosen, it doesn't move.
There have been measurements of the diffusion of Halliday junctions during recombination in the context of RAC-A.
Uh-huh.
How does it compare? So the diffusion rate of a single homologous junction between two double-stranded DNA.
So, well, the branch migration that occurs spontaneously is a strong function of solution condition. If you have high migration concentration, then it is very slow because it mostly spends time in the stack form. But when you have proteins, it becomes faster because protein basically constrains the molecule into the open conformation where the spontaneous branch migration can be much faster. We have compared our branch migration data with bulk phase branch migration data without proteins, and we got very good agreement when you average over many different sequences.
So these rates would be different if you add RAC A?
Yeah. So when you do this RUB AB type of branch migration enzyme experiments, and there have been some publications using magnetic tweezers and so on, and the rate is on the order of about 50 base pairs per second for the catalyzed branch migration. And in our measurements, it's spontaneous branch migration is much slower. So now we are moving into more of a technical development phase of this talk. So here we're trying to do a thread between three different colors. Motivation is shown here. If you have two dyes showing, giving you a single distance, it can if a molecule is simple with one hinge, for example, then this is all the information you need, more or less. But if the system is more complex, for example, two hinges and so on, then measuring one distance is not enough. So you like to get more information by attaching another dye, than trying to get distance information between different combinations from the same molecule. So again, we are using this DNA junction as a model system. Notice that there is this one arm that is not labeled. So technically, you can ask this question. When this green arm is moving away from the red arm in this direction, what happens to this unlabeled arm? Does it come toward the green arm, does it come toward this green arm when the red arm is moving away? Does this guy come toward the green arm at the same time in a synchronized manner, or is there a time delay? So you could do this measurement by adding a third dye of different color called Psi 5.5, which is actually based on another acceptor of a different color. And then you can imagine this donor can give transfer energy to this one mainly in one conformation and transfer energy to the second acceptor in the other conformation. Okay, so can you do this measurement? And yes, it was a little bit difficult because of the close spectral position between the two dyes, but it was in the end possible. What I'm showing you here is a thread efficiency toward the red dye versus purple dye from the donor as a function of time of a single molecule. But you can see the thread efficiency to the red dye is fluctuating, and also purple dye is also fluctuating, and they are fluctuating in an anticorrelated manner. Okay? In fact, if you zoom in, you can show that they are synchronized. Okay? And then later on, the purple dye photobleaches, so you only get a red dye fluctuating. And
what do you mean by synchronized? Do you mean the transitions occur at the same time?
So if my head is the green dye, okay, and then I have red and purple. So what happens is that when purple is coming here, then red is moving away at the same time. There's no delay of this type that you could measure. So it is a strictly two-state system.
You don't form triple strands at any point that you can rule out.
That's right, yeah. That's right.
It seems clear that, say, one conformation is favored over the other. Is it not the blue?
Is this is a different sequence. A preference about 3-1. Yeah. Okay. So I think we think this is the first time that anybody measured the correlate movements of two different segments of a single biomolecule. Although conclusion was very trivial, we expected two-state system, we found two-state system, but again, you cannot really claim that strong conclusion based on just regular two-color thread measurements.
Did you expect the 3-1 ratio?
Well, we knew that this had bias based on just two-color measurements, also from previous gel electrophoresis measurements. And again, and also when you move the dyes around, the bias doesn't change. So dyes have many minimal effect on the rates of bias, and presumably because they are far away from the central core of the molecule. So this is a topic that I mentioned briefly earlier, quantum dots. So ultimate goal of a single molecule spectroscopy may be to measure all these things inside a living cell, but it's difficult to do so because of high background coming from the living cell. And so you need a light source that is brighter than organic dyes. And this colloidal quantum dots are based on usually 2,6 compounds, cat selenide and so on. They are very nice because they are very photostable, and they're much brighter than organic dyes. But many people have observed a severe blinking of this quantum dot that limited its applications in biological field. So a couple of years ago, I asked my postdoc to buy some quantum dots from a company that was just becoming commercialized. And he measured this quantum dot and then found, indeed, the molecule was blinking as you expect as a function of time, turning on and off. But surprisingly, when he added our typical imaging buffer that we use in our single molecule studies to reduce the photo bleaching of the dye molecules, then most quantum dots, 80% of them actually more or less stop blinking. Okay, so and while maintaining the same intensity at the high intensity level, and then he was able to remove different compounds to conclude that what was responsible for was this beta mecaptive ethanol that contains a small thiol group, sulfhydryl group, and that thiol group makes this compound very stinky. In fact, when I was a postdoc with Stephen Chu, we joked in the lab that we use this thiol in the lab so that Steve never comes to the lab, okay, because it's so stinky. So when I stayed in my own lab, actually, I made sure that my lab has very good ventilation. So anyway, this is one example where you're looking at a single quantum dot, which is blinking, and then use a flow system to flow in beta mecaptive ethanol, and then boom, basically it becomes more or less non-blinking, and it's good enough for single molecule measurements. And then if you wash it away, then it starts blinking again. So it's a reversible effect. It works with cysteine well, it works with DTT well. It doesn't work with glutathione, which is not as small. Okay, and in fact, it would be nice if it works with glutathione because it's a thiol that is found in the cell, in the cytosol, in high concentration. And it doesn't work, and my guess is that these small molecules have to penetrate the coating of the quantum dot to get the traps on the surface, and if the compound is larger, it doesn't do that as well.
What is the surface treatment of the quantum dot? There's special surface treatment for thiol groups
Well, when the quantum dots are synthesized, usually in the colloidal phase, they add some chemicals called topo, whatever, to stop the growth, I guess there are defects, and I think blinking is thought to be caused by the trapping of the of the electron in one of the traps for a long time, and then the dot becomes charged and then non-emitting until that trapped electron comes back to the quantum dot to recombine, and then it emits again. So if you passivate, remove the surface trap size by using these guys, maybe that effect disappears. So that's our thought, but I am sure there are other possibilities. So we thought it would be very nice if you can then use a quantum dot as a donor, because then even if the acceptor is an organic dye, you can use 20 times less laser intensity to do the single molecule study, and then you, in the cell you can generate single molecule data with a 20 times low background. Okay, so we have measured this using the quantum dot as a donor, but also we use the quantum dot as a way of immobilizing the four-way junction, and we did see fluctuations in the quantum dot and psi 5 intensities here, shown here, but not very strong. But if you compare it to the fluctuation of the same molecule but using organic dye, you measure the exactly identical time scale of dynamics. So that seems to show that this approach could work, but the problem was that only about 1% of molecules showed any effect at all, probably because the quantum dot was just too large. And you just have to be very lucky that DNA gets attached to very near the core of the molecule to give you any threat. So there's much, you know, room for improvement in the synthesis, so that maybe that they can now be made much smaller. So in this part, we are trying to combine threat with two dyes with an extra dimension of force. And this is the motivation. This is Dr. Forster, who invented FRET, and 3 or 4 years before he died, Robert Knox was a professor in Rochester, and they were getting ready to play frisbee. So when Robert Knox sent me this picture, he named this picture this way: Forster prepares for mechanical energy transfer. I was motivated by this. Okay, now we have to combine FRET with the mechanical force. And so, there are, you know, additional strong motivations for doing this. If you use this combination, you can measure the effect of force at arbitrary low forces. In fact, you know, most of our measurements are done at zero forces. While if you measure small molecules conformational changes using the optical trap or magnetic trap force alone, then you have to apply, you know, substantial force to straighten out the DNA tethers and so on in order to reduce the noise. So if an interesting effect of force kicks in at very low forces, then here we may have a chance to see them. Another motivation is that, you know, typical optical trap measurement, you only measure the end-to-end distance of your molecule, while in principle fluorescence measurement can be done to measure different vectors by moving the dyes around on the molecule. And there have been several nice previous studies in this direction, you know, notably from the Block lab and also from Lippard lab in Berkeley. But it's fair to say that no one has shown that the conformational changes and dynamics of single molecule can be measured by fluorescence as a function of force. So this is where we come in. So again, I think by now you're getting sick of this diagram, but this is Hardy junction. Again, there is one free arm here. So the question is, what happens if you apply force to this free arm? Okay. What the force is trying to do is trying to favor the conformation where the distance between the two attachment points here and here is longer, okay? So, you know, intuitively, if you increase the force, you favor this conformation shown on the right side. And the range will change accordingly. So my postdoc, Sung Chul Hong, who I basically started buying parts about 2 years ago, and he built the setup. And in terms of molecule, what he did was to extend one arm by 12 nucleotides to attach it to a long phage DNA, lambda DNA, 50 kilobase pairs long. If you stretch it fully, it's about 16 micrometers. And then the other end of the DNA is held by a 1 micron size bead that is trapped using a focused laser beam in an optical trap configuration. And then you can also use a focused laser beam to measure the fluorescence from the single molecule in a confocal microscope.
Did you use force feedback to apply constant force?
We did not. Okay. And in fact, what's nice about this long DNA tether is that this is a very weak spring. Yeah. And so, you know, few nanometer scale movement here does not actually show up here. Okay. In fact, effectively, it's a
constant.
Yeah.
Well, actually, the force of this is a thermal spring. I think this is something you cannot ignore in this analysis. If you have a thermal spring here, so you have big fluctuations on this.
Yeah, yeah.
On average constant force.
Yeah, yeah. But that's true for any optical trip experiment, right?
Well, the magnitude of fluctuations varies, right? The magnitude of fluctuations varies.
Well, if you'd imagine that there would be effectively two-state level of the DNA tether that would mask the two-state level which you're trying to probe.
Yeah, so basically you cannot measure this two-state fluctuation by looking at the bead, because the DNA tether is so long. Okay? But you can measure by using fluorescence. But what you do is we take the force extension curve, and then we set the distance at different positions, at defined forces, and then take fret measurements at different forces from the same molecule.
I'm trying to hear what's being said. It sounds very important. Mm-hmm. There's one way to think. It's such a soft spring. Mm-hmm. If you keep attention on it, mm-hmm. no matter what happens, if the left hand down, the force is staying the same. But there's another thought that guy in between is kind of interesting on his own.
Yes.
And he may have a life of his own. He may, even with the constraint he's putting up on the upper right side, maybe exerting a huge range of forces, maybe slower varying.
He should be able to tell you the range of forces.
Could I at least hear the question?
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah. So what is the range of forces there?
What's the extension of it? What's how do you usually pull?
Well. I mean, I think in the data that I showed, they are at least about 9 microns in length.
Okay.
Yeah.
So you would get the range of forces, I think, you know about what the spring constant should be at that extension, what the spring constant of the DNA molecule is at that extension. And then you just have K times KBT, I think.
Well, there is no really a spring, this is a highly nonlinear system.
F squared, yeah. So something like F squared. Is something K times KBT,
yeah.
I think.
Where would KBT hold the force constants? The root is square deviation.
Yes, in terms of forces, then you would have K, so the square root K times KBT, I think.
Well, we haven't calculated this. I guess we could go and look at it.
Typically, if you have a very soft spring, what you do is you measure the tonal fluctuation, like if you have an AFM.
Mm-hmm.
If a very stiff AFM, mm-hmm. then you can see very small displacements.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas if you have a very soft AFM, you just try to monitor the tonal fluctuation of the system itself.
But they're not trying to measure distance, they just want to pull.
No, right? But in the optical trap, the distance is fixed, so the force fluctuates. That's the argument. And the force, the fluctuation, the force is not really.
Yeah, the distance is fixed, but the force is fluctuating. And I guess, as Klaus suggested, it should be possible to estimate the force level. We just haven't done that. But this is a very interesting point because, we are thinking of doing the measurement at a constant force, but in fact, if the force is fluctuating by a large amount, then even a very rare excursion to high force could actually tip the balance and then induce a transition.
Fluctuations will give you all the information you need. If you analyze the frequency spectrum
of the bead itself,
in the same way as you do with an AFM.
Of the bead itself.
That's right.
Uh-huh.
Then you might be able to get the whole information of both the combined DNA tether with your attached with your two-level system.
Mm-hmm. I think the fluctuation of the bead itself are mostly dominated by the bead moving in.
In the potential of the trap, yeah.
Yeah. You won't see, on its own, you won't see much of the fluctuations of the DNA on the bead, I think.
No.
I agree with him. For such a long DNA, that'll be difficult to see. So, for example, Carlos Bustamante's lab have measured RNA hairpin zipping unzipping using optical trap, but in order to do that, they had to use 100 times shorter DNA tether, 500 base pair. Okay, because if you make a long DNA tether, you max the effect.
Mm-hmm.
But when Stephen Block did this combined experiment, the trouble that they saw was that basically when they use a short DNA tether, two lasers overlap, and then you get like 10 times enhanced photoblishing of the dyes because of the effect of the infrared laser. And Steve is coming from the trapping field, so he doesn't want to sacrifice anything about the trapping resolution, because he has to use short DNA, but we are coming from the fluorescence field. So, and as long as we do good fluorescence measurement, at this point it was okay. So it's kind of nice compromise.
Yeah.
But I mean, your concerns are, you know, valid, and this is something that, you know, one has to take into account in interpreting the data. Yeah.
So I'm not clear. What kinds of measurements would be made to clear this up? Did you just put another beta together and see popping around?
Yeah, I mean, that's something we have actually done. We have put beats on both ends and looked at the cross correlations between the two beats, and so we have done those measurements. And
yeah, he published a couple of papers in PRL, with Steve Craig.
If you look at the force correlations there, it's pretty much this. So for the forces,
in the femtonewton range, right?
Depends on how strong you pull it on it. Uh-huh. And so you really will get something for the forces, something F squared is K times KBT.
I'm also wondering, characteristic times, short, long.
Again, depends on how strong you pull, but probably millisecond at 9 microns.
Yeah, I guess the question is also time scale of the fluctuations. Yeah,
exactly.
This
guy over on the left might not be averaging overall.
Do you know the time scale of the fluctuations?
Again, it depends on the extension, but I would say milliseconds probably for that type of extension, a millisecond or two or three, something like that.
2 or 3 milliseconds.
You can again get it, you know, what the friction coefficient of your DNA molecule is. You know what the spring constant of your DNA molecule is, and
frequency match it. I mean, there's a certain frequency window. Mm-hmm. DNA tethered is like a transducer in an electronic circuit, and you have to match the frequency range of the tether with the characteristic over the frequency range of your state system.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not trying to sell magnetic tweezers, but why didn't you use magnetic tweezers?
Well, it's just history. I mean, we started doing the magnetic trap and total internal reflection fluorescence combination 2 years before we started doing optical trap and confocal combination. But the first one was studied by a graduate student, and this was studied by a postdoc, and he was just faster. So we started working, so we dropped magnetic trap. And I think maybe optical trap is easier to do than magnetic trap. I don't know. We have to get some help from you. Yeah. But it'll be nice also to do it with magnetic trap, especially if you want to do the measurement as a function of torque and so on. Right. So this is one example. This is one molecule showing two-step fluctuations as a function of time. This is over 5 seconds, and this is at a lower force, and then the molecule is still alive, so you take additional 5 seconds of data, 3 piconewton, 4 piconewton, and another 5 seconds, and now you see a big bias toward the low first state. This is the bias that you expect, and then at 10 piconewton, now it's almost always in the low first state, but we still brief excursions to the high first state. And now if you go back to the low force, then you recover this behavior. So the force effect here is reversible. And you can do this several times when you're lucky. So you can get good statistics from a single molecule.
Hey,
yes?
I want to follow up on what Udo asked earlier.
Yes.
You might have the same diabolical plan. So could you apply this force in a time-dependent way?
We could, yes. Okay.
Another question, if you're in this intermediate range where you have still both levels calculated, have you looked at the dwell time statistics? Because if it's a fluctuating force, you presumably would not expect single exponential behavior.
Yeah, so we had this molecule was a very good molecule to us, because it lasted 5 cycles of this type. So we are able to kind of get the dual-time histograms and fit the data. And we fit the data using a single exponential decay. But still, data is still noisy. So we didn't feel that it justified the fitting using any fancier function. Okay? So this is where we are in terms of our capability, signal-to-noise ratio, and how much data we can get. It looks like single exponential within the noise data. So anyway, this is from that, one molecule. what you do is you determine the rate of fluctuations, you know, forward and backward transitions shown in the log scale as a function of force. So green is for the transition going forward, which increases as you increase the force. That's the right direction that you expect. The red curve is the backward reaction going back, which decreases with force, again, as you expect. What we did not expect was that if you look at the slopes, they are not the same. The slope is much larger in the backward reaction. So the effective force is much larger in the backward reaction than in the forward reaction. So if you think of it in terms of free energy along the reaction coordinate, along the pulling direction, this data can be explained if you assume that the highest energy transition state lies closer to the state on the left. Okay, then when you apply force to tilt the energy, lens energy in this direction, adding a slope shown here, then you will reduce the energies, you know, relative to this point here and here, but that reduction in energy is much larger here than here because of smaller separation, so that you don't change the barrier against the forward reaction very much, but you change the barrier height against the backward reaction by a lot. Okay? And
I'm a little bit confused by the delta x. Like, would it make more sense for that coordinate to be an angle rather than a distance?
That's a good point. Here, basically, what you're saying, what you're measuring, denoting, is the distance between the two attachment points. Okay. Okay.
In actuality, it's more if you're applying torque than a force. It seems to me.
It's a very good point. I'll show you some data that I was not going to show, to actually for this question. So anyway, so.
But you're saying that the arms are fairly short and stiff, so you can just convert it to an angle because you know the length.
I think I'm not going to show data. So let me just explain what we did. So this was obtained using 11 base pair arm duplex, very short, and so it must be very stiff. Mm-hmm. We did the same measurement where we lengthen these arms by a factor of 2, so you go to 21 base pairs on both arms. Then if you imagine that a certain torque is required to bias the molecule by a certain amount, then you can achieve the same torque at half the force if the arms are longer, the lever arm effect. So can you see that? Yes. In fact, slopes are reduced by a factor of 2 from that experiment.
So it's consistent with sort of an angular barrier.
Yeah. So okay, again, so this is a diagram that can explain our data, but you know, if that open structure that I showed you earlier is this transition state, then you know, if you measure the length, arm length and so on from the crystal structures and so on, it does not make any sense. You know, in fact, I asked Klaus' student to, you know, do some modeling to measure the distances and so on, but you know, if at all, it'll be closer to this side than here. So we couldn't explain this by that reasoning. So, you know, one possibility is shown here. If you actually assume that this open state is a true intermediate, you know, not as deep shown here, but you know, shallow intermediate in between, then there have to be two activated states between the three states, and these two high energy states may be similar in energy. Now, if you apply force, then you are tilting the energy. Then you are effectively picking the winner among the two. So the force is actually picking the winner, which becomes the highest energy state. And by definition, that the picked winner will be closer to this conformation in location. And this model will explain our data. And if this is true, then you know, this would be a supporting evidence that this open state is a true intermediate. We do have this model has a prediction. You know, what will happen if you move the pulling arms to different locations and see how the rates change, And we need to do that experiment. That's the reason why we haven't actually published this yet. But my postdoc finally came back from his job trails, and so he has now three more months to finish that experiment before he starts his own group. So,
did you see any rate dependence in this? The rate at which you're applying you shouldn't be applying.
So we are not. You know, we are measuring kind of two-state system
with at a fixed
force. We are not ramping the force.
But you have not. Okay.
We haven't done. This measurement. I mean, we may want to go to a different system because this ticking rate is really high for this Hadley junction, and under the most favorable condition, is you know it ticks maybe 20 times, maybe 10 times a second, even without any force. So we think that this is a first fluorescent detection of conformational fluctuations as a function of force, and what's around the corner. Well, we are now using this technique to study many different nucleic acid systems and proteins binding and working on nucleic acids. Now we are building a new setup that will have improved force sensitivity and force clamp and shorter DNA tether and so on. And my students claim that the machine will be as good as Stephen Block's machine, but I don't think so. But as long as it's about factor of two worst, that's fine. And we are also trying to help some people, you know, calibrating their intracellular tension sensors based on fluorescent proteins. Am I doing fine?
No, you're fine.
Okay. Yeah. So the last subject is the new data that we obtained on a protein called RAC-K, which is important for recombination. And here we get a very complex fret trajectories, not just two or four states, but very complex. And we wanted to have a more reliable, objective in that way of analyzing the data. So we adopted a hidden Markov modeling and for our analysis of fret trajectories. So I want to show you some data and then show you how we analyze the data. Perhaps you can also tell me what we are doing wrong and so on. Recombination-dependent DNA repair. When DNA damage occurs, oftentimes you get a break on the DNA, double-stranded DNA break, and this needs to be repaired. And a prime pathway of repairing this is through homologous recombination. In fact, Hadley junction is involved in this process as well. So if you have a damaged DNA with a break here, then this somehow needs to find a homologous DNA that is intact, and then recombine and to repair the DNA damage. And this is done by a first, degrading one strand of the damaged DNA to form the 3' prime overhang of single strand DNA. And then this finds a homologous DNA to form the joint DNA and then branch migration and so on to start recombination. RAC-K is a protein that forms a filament around the single strand DNA, helical filament, and searches for the homology on the duplex DNA. This is the crystal structure of the RAC-K filament. The DNA was not resolved in the crystal structure, or was not there. This is just a render, kind of cartoon shape of this structure. The pitch of the helix is about 18 nucleotides, so about 6 monomers are responsible for one turn. And one monomer of the RAC-K protein occupies about 3 nucleotides of single-strand DNA. And the limiting step in RAC-K filament formation is the nucleation, presumably due to a simultaneous binding of several RAC-K monomers to a certain site on the DNA. And then the extension of the filament can occur very rapidly once a nucleation happens. And that extension is mostly toward the 3' prime end. And dissociation mostly occurs from the 5' prime end. Okay. Sorry. See. So that's just animation of what might be going on.
We've actually seen threat measurements of this process of creation sites of different places.
Yeah, we have done some threat measurement. I'll show you some data relevant to the modeling analysis.
Wasn't there some arguments that were like by people in Shepard's lab about the grid stability in there was something like that, right?
Mm-hmm. That's right.
Yeah.
Disputed. Some people are questioning Lipschaber's.
So Lipschaber published many papers on RedK, but there was a paper in PRL 2 years ago. And he modeled this filament growth kinetics. And what he didn't include was the basically this animation shows that it grows only in the 3' direction. It comes off only in the 5' direction. So that's actually what his model was. He didn't include the binding in the 5' direction. But actually our data suggests that it does bind the 5' direction, but it's much slower than 10 times slower than the binding in the 3' direction. So it just could not be seen easily in bulk phase studies.
Yeah. You also saw fluorescence on the 5' end growing slower than the 3' end, but it is.
Oh, there's Steve Kochkowski. Yeah. But that's double-stranded DNA that he was studying. Double-stranded DNA.
Double-stranded DNA. I think it showed that basically they grow in both ends.
Yeah.
That's right.
Faster so, on the 3' end.
Well, he couldn't tell which one is which because he was studying double-stranded DNA, but based on bulk phase studies, over the last 20 years, it's very likely that.
And Lipschaber was on single-stranded or double-stranded?
Double-stranded.
Single-stranded.
Oh, I thought it was single-stranded.
Well, he had a study done using optical trap in double-stranded DNA. Yeah. But more recent studies are based on fluorescence measurements of, ensemble-level fluorescence measurement anisotropy on single-stranded DNA.
But in vivo, spontaneously, I think that RedK really assembles on single-stranded DNA.
I think the most functionally relevant formation is on single-stranded DNA, because then it seeks the double-stranded DNA.
But Kowalczykowski found, I cannot pronounce his name, that
Steve K. Yeah.
There's also nucleates on double-stranded.
That's right. He does experiments at low pH that favors nucleation, and also he uses ATP gamma S, not ATP, which also favors right. Nucleation double-stranded DNA. Well,
so would it be correct to say that you can get it to nucleate and form filaments in double-stranded DNA, but that's thought to be unlikely in vivo?
Yeah, I think this is more relevant biologically, but although there are some some rare cases where de novo formation on double-stranded DNA could be important. I mean, Steve has a paper a few years back. So anyway, I think fluorescence actually single molecule FRET actually is actually quite nicely suited for measuring the dynamics on the single-stranded DNA, because you can make you can measure the dynamics on a fairly short single-stranded DNA that is difficult to measure in force measurements. And it's also difficult to measure, make very long single-stranded DNA reliable and so on, although many measurements have already been done. So this is the experiment. We have double-stranded DNA with a 3' single-stranded DNA tail, and we attach the donor and acceptor dyes to the basically two ends of the single-stranded DNA tail in order to monitor the average end-to-end distance between the two dyes. Or single-stranded DNA, and single-stranded DNA is highly flexible. In fact, its conformational flexibility is so large that we cannot measure any time dependence when you just measure the DNA. Its averages are so rapidly, so you get a relatively high FRET because of flexibility. But if the RedK filament forms, then you'd imagine that the dyes will be far away from each other, and you get low FRET. So that's our assay.
How big is the filament? Oh, yes, you see. 21.
Well,
how many monomers are breaking into 21?
Well, 21 divided by 3 is 7. So I guess my student drew 7 here. But, you know. But so what we did, but here the filament does not form stably because it's too short. So what we did is we went to a longer DNA. But then, if you put two dyes at the ends of a long DNA, then you get very low fat to begin with. So it's not very useful. So what we did was to move the donor dye 13 nucleotides away from the acceptor, somewhere in the middle, and you attach it without disrupting the DNA backbone. And we also have done ATPase assays and so on, and others to verify that this modification does not affect the RECK activity. And then this filament would form rather stably, but filament grows mainly in this direction, in the 3' direction. So this part will be actually the unstable end, disassembling end, and which can be highly dynamic. In fact, if you measure fret histograms here, then you get many, many, fret states. But that, it's not very easy to resolve them. So now, if you look at a single molecule and then you measure fret as a function of time from a single DNA molecule, this is what we see. This is like kind of typical noisy data we get from an experiment of this type. You see many, many different, fret levels and complex dynamics. So we thought there are probably up to four monomers binding in this DNA segment, because 13 divided by 4 is about 3. Sorry, 3 is about 4. So you expect to see maybe about 5 states, 0 monomer, 1, 2, 3, 4. But if I show this to even to my mother and tell her that there are 5 states, even my mother would not believe that. So so we wanted to analyze the data.
It's the maximally sympathetic observer.
Why don't you do some averaging, David would suggest, huh? Never mind.
Yeah, my mother is also very sympathetic. When Dr. Huang published these papers last year, she was worried that I had nothing to study because she was going to... Well,
is there any utility just as a sanity check to take your y-axis and plot 1 over the y-axis minus 1 to the 6th root, just so that the... you get some sense of whether or not you're really measuring the distances that you think you should be measuring?
That turns out to be about right within our precision. We don't really know exactly what our knot is like, so but within that precision it turns out to be right. Okay. Yeah.
So the switching from high fret to low fret is just because you're stiffening it, right?
Yeah, so basically low fret is more likely when there are more monomers bound to the segment. And high fret is when there are less of them bound to the segment. Okay.
So the spacing must be more than one persistence length of single-stranded DNA, which is of course not much.
Yeah, persistence length is probably 3 or 4 nucleotides. Under this condition, we have magnesium ions, which makes the persistence length short, because the RECK requires ATP as a cofactor. So what we did was, we think that we go between high and low fret state, but it's hard to really pinpoint what is going on. So my student Sean McKinney, devised and adopted this method. What basically is, more or less unbiased statistical analysis, and assume there are like 10 different fret states with unspecified rates, and then you do a brute force optimization to fit the data. Of course, the trajectory has to be long enough for doing this reliably. You can see there's a break in the trajectory here. And there's no assumption other than that we assume this is a Markovian process. And then we run it on a 1,000 processor cluster. So actually, I was happy that we did something that used many computers. I had this supercomputing envy, but anyway. So then this is the...
Usually at HMMs, there's an assumption on the maximum number of states
it will
allow.
We assume there are 10.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's your question.
Hmm?
how many states there are. So you really need to do some kind of model selection at the end.
That's right. I will show you. Okay. I will show you that. Yeah, yeah. So this is the result of the analysis. So you get these green curves, but still, it's not clear.
Do you fix the position of your tensor?
No. It's also variable. And also, rates of transitions are all very, you know, basic parameters. So it's expensive computationally. So you don't want we didn't want to go more than 10 states. And also, you know, realistically, I don't think we can measure more than 10 states in FET measurements anyway. So, you know, if there are more than 10 states, then we just give up.
How do you make sure that the nucleation always starts at the domain?
Oh, we don't know. The nucleation can
nucleate anywhere.
It can nucleate anywhere, yeah.
Would you change that number, like the 5, and see if you can go to that agreement?
So what happened was that, we also did 5, not for this data, for highly dense two-state system, we start with 5 because there's no point in going to 10. Then, you know, we get the same number that you get as you analyze using, of course, visually, manually. And in this case, if you start with 10, what happens is that, you know, some of the states, in the final come up, you know, beyond 100% fail, you know, basically, because we have noise, the FET value can go above 1 or below 0. Some FET states actually are found outside this range, so they ignore them. So this seems to be quite robust. In fact, we are using this analysis for other measurements, other systems. Just my students, just you know, some other students will just use this to analyze their own data and so on. So you get this data, and then what the next thing that we do is how do you get something some information out of this kind of fitting? So we made this so-called transition density plot, which is basically a two-dimensional histogram. So when you have a transition that's seen here from FET of 0.7 to FET of 0.5, there's one transition there. Then for this transition, then we add a data point to this density plot based on the FET value on the x-axis before the transition and FET value after the transition. And then you add this data point, but you know here just we just add basically Gaussian p with a certain certain risk to get some reasonable shape in the end. And then you go through more than 100 molecules and more than 10,000 transitions, then and you compile all the data. This is the result that we got. Okay, this under one condition. This is 165 molecules, 17,000 transitions. And you can see some structures here in this diagram. And what you can do is the following. If you actually add some grid here, you can even do this actually using information theory to show that this is also this can be done without actually human intervention. But basically what you do is that you project FET values in the x-axis, that there's a peak at point 2 or so, there's a peak at point 3 or so, there's another peak here, another peak here. So it seems like there are 4 states in FET. And also if you project in the vertical axis, there are also 4 states. Okay? That means now this peak corresponds to a transition from point 3 to point 2 and so on. Okay? So and they are diagonally symmetric. So what happens, our basically the interpretation here is that you start from the lowest FET where there are the maximum number of molecules occupying this segment. In this case, we think it's 3. And then you go to a state where you have 2 molecules. So your FET actually goes go up a little bit because now DNA has been exposed, which is more flexible. So that's why you go from low FET to higher FET. And then you start from this one to lose a monomer to go to one monomer bound state. Then that'll be from 0.3 to 0.6. Okay, that's this transition. And then when you go from here to here, that'll be from here to here. That's that transition. Okay, so these peaks will correspond to the dissociation of individual monomers. And these other peaks would correspond to the binding of individual monomers to the filament. And also the analysis also gives you the rate of individual transitions. And it turns out that the dissociation rate is highly close to the ATP hydrolysis rate measured in bulk. And it's known that ATP hydrolysis is followed by red K monomer dissociation, so the data seems quite reasonable. But this means that there are only three monomers bound to the 13 nucleated segments, not four, as we hope to see. So it's not clear why that's the case. But to test this further, Chun Min-ju, my student, made the same DNA. Now that instead of having 13 nucleotides, she made the segments shorter, 10 and 5. And then now you can see that instead of having three transition, you know, basically peaks for transitions, now you have two transitions peaks for the dissociation and binding. So suggesting that for 10 nucleotide segments, primarily there are two monomers occupying the segments. When you go to five nucleotide segments, you see mainly just one transition peak between the two peaks. So that seems to scale nicely with an expectation. So we think that our interpretation that we are measuring the binding and dissociation of a single monomer is actually it's okay. So if this is true, then what we really have observed is that we are actually measuring the red K protein addition in the 5' direction when you go in this direction, which is kind of surprising, but it's not entirely contradictory to bulk phase measurement, because it was very hard to measure something of this kind in bulk. All right, so that's all I have to say. And these are the students and postdocs in my group who contributed data to this talk. And many of the Hollywood Junction studies are done in collaboration with David Lilly from University of Dundee, who has done a lot of pioneering structural and biochemical studies on Hollywood Junction. Thank you very much. Finished on time, or?
Absolutely, perfect.
Were you surprised to see that the on rates and off rates between those transitions on the red K filament were very similar?
So this is at this data is at the lowest red K concentration we use, 0.25 micromolar. When you go to higher, on rate goes up, but the dissociation rate does not change. And in the cell, probably there's at least one micromolar red K there. So that suggests that there can be some real growth going on in the 5' direction under physiological conditions as well. But but the binding rate is about 10 times slower in the 5' direction. But we also have data in the 3' direction. The 3' direction is 10 times faster binding, while the dissociation rate is the same. So basically, directional filament growth in the 3' direction appears to be due to the difference in the binding rate, not difference in the dissociation rate.
I'm still thinking, going way back, quick question, make sure I understand. The magnesium effect on this change in the
yes.
You talked about before. So is the short form of the answer that the ratio is not changing because whatever that is, not so sensitive to salt and magnesium.
Because they are
loosening,
yeah.
Perhaps because of the lack of salt or lack of magnesium or whatever. So that's just saying it's a simple statement of making the transition state lower.
Let me try to draw it here. So this is the way
it was really a simple answer. I want to take in my head when I leave. I want to. Sure.
I give you an answer that I think is simple, but usually my answers are usually wrong. So don't take it away with it. Don't go home with it. Yeah. So I think my view of the energy diagram is this. Basically, you have this open state as an intermediate state.
Yeah.
That looks like that. Under with magnesium, but when you add more magnesium, what happens is that you are stabilizing this stack structure more, because magnesium ions are binding there and further reducing the energetic cost of the negative charges, the phosphate ions there, Okay. So then you are, you know, then you are.
Oh, so you're putting it on the minima with the same idea.
Yeah.
The energy barrier is functional.
When you then, if you now go to very low magnesium ion concentration, then you will eventually go to a point where, you know, you may have this, right? And this is a condition where you would expect to see three-state fluctuation from single molecule measurements, but we couldn't see this, and presumably because now the energy barrier is already too small, so transitions become too fast for us to resolve this anyway. And then when you have no magnesium ions, presumably maybe what happens is something like this. Okay, so there may be a continuous transition going between, you know, different shapes. That's the view I have. Okay.
Thanks.
Yeah.
Thank you very much.
Okay.
Yeah. You get the prize for the most versatile.